The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 7 of this 7-day sesshin here in March 2017. A lot of sevens here. At Turtleback Zendo in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And we're almost through with sesshin, actually. It's only the last few hours remain, so give yourself the very best and a sprint to the finish. And it's already been a fine sesshin. Take it even deeper. I'd like to share with you today a little bit of background for our practice. Starting with the fact that Buddhism diverged into two, and ultimately the question of whether it's really three or whether it's just two streams. The Theravadin stream, which is also translated as the Way of the Elders, which is considered to be the earlier teachings of the Buddha, and the Mahayana, which is translated as the Great Vehicle. And sometimes the Vajrayana, which is the Tibetan form of Buddhism, is a subset of the Mahayana. Sometimes it considers itself completely separate. So, but we will deal with the Theravadin and the Mahayana today. The difference between the Theravada system and the Mahayana system is that in the Theravada, the emphasis, at least in terms of English translations, is on coming to awakening for your own benefit. It's to become free of your own suffering and as part of that freedom, not to be born again. This is in direct contrast with the Dalai Lama, who expresses the Mahayana view when he says that I vow to be born again and again until all beings are free of suffering. And as part of the Mahayana view, and that's why it's the great vehicle, because it has room for everybody, and that's the point. It is meant to be for everybody, to come to awakening for the benefit of all beings and for the relief of all beings suffering. And as part of the Mahayana, there is what we call the Bodhisattva vows. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless, I vow to master them. And the way of liberation is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. And we chant those daily in both Japanese and in English translation. And I'd like to say something about the fact that we continue to do some of our chants in Japanese, as well as transliterated Sanskrit, which are the Dharanis, the Dahishin Dharani, the Shosamya Dharani. These are our transliterations. D.T. Suzuki spent some efforts in translating the Dahishin Dharani based on the Chinese characters that it was transliterated into when it came from India. And you can read it, but it is not especially inspiring. Dharanis are meant to be inspiring and helpful through their sound, not necessarily through their translations or through their words, but rather to the sounds. And there is a great deal of information about sound in terms of healing, for example. And we won't go there right now. So we have chants in Japanese, like the Hanyashinyo, which is the Japanese translation of the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, the Heart of Perfect Wisdom. And that's it, basically. The rest of them had been translated and are done English version, except for the Shiku Seigan, which are the four vows, the four bodhisattva vows in Japanese. And we chant those two sets of chants in Japanese still because we have a long-standing connection with Japan. And as a matter of fact, Haruta Roshi came to visit Mountain Gate several years ago. And it honors our Japanese history connection to continue doing those chants in Japanese. In addition to that, for any Japanese or Chinese speaker, particularly Japanese speaker, to chant the Prajnaparamita in Japanese is a familiar thing. It's the one chant that seems to be universal in all the different sects in Japan, beyond Zen. And because on occasion we have at the different temples, Hidden Valley Zen Center, Mountain Gate, I'm not sure we have it yet here at Turtleback Zendo, but we do have visitors from Japan. And it's honoring to them to be able to, for them to be able to understand and to chant along with us in their own language. Although that said, the Hanya Shigyo is in such archaic form of Japanese that the Japanese have to have a transliteration themselves to read it. But that's beside the point. So the Mahayana sect is considered to have developed later in Asia, South Asia, South Asia. The only Southeast Asian country that has adopted Mahayana Zen is Vietnam. The other Southeast Asian countries, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, all are Theravadan countries. And again, the point in the Mahayana is to come to awakening for the benefit of all beings, not just for our own personal self-satisfaction, as Haruta Roshi periodically will say. And because of that, these vows have developed, those that we call the Bodhisattva vows. The Bodhisattva is one who vows not to take the final step into Buddhahood until all beings are liberated. This is a tall order, but one of profound compassion, and that is part of those of us here at Turtleback Zendo. Getting to the vows themselves, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. Think that the Diamond Sangha's translation adds all. I vow to liberate them all. And that's appropriate as well. Sentient beings there are a number of nuances to that term and a number of different representations of it. The sixth patriarch, in his first ever Taisho, after he had been living in obscuration ever since he had left the fifth patriarch's temple with the rope and the bowl, continuing to deepen himself as was instructed by the fifth patriarch, eventually was revealed when he went to hear a talk at a temple and was recognized because of his depth of understanding. And that depth of understanding occurred around a set of flags that were flying at the temple at the time, announcing the Dharma talk of the master of the temple. And Eno Daishi, or Wei Ning, whichever name you want to call him by, my name is his Chinese name. Eno is how it's pronounced in Japanese. The characters, the same characters. So these monks were arguing about whether it was the wind or the flags that were moving. And they're going back and forth on this, and it's getting heated. And Eno comes up and says, it's not the wind or the flag, it's your venerable minds that are moving. And everybody sat up and took notice. And they had heard that there was a sixth patriarch somewhere. And they asked if that was he, and he admitted it was. And so he was asked to give a series of talks. And in one of those talks, he spoke about liberating sentient beings from our own mind. And that has, as I said, multiple meanings. Mind with a capital M is all-inclusive of everything and yet holds nothing. Mind with a small M is our own mind. And we are conditioned, and we have ideas, and we have thoughts, and we have assumptions. And sentient, of course, refers to thinking. And these trap us. Thoughts beget a self-image, reinforce a self-image, and that motivates us, or causes us even, to react to situations out of a need to protect that self-image, or stand up for that self-image, or support that self-image in some way. And it interferes with our actually being able simply to respond to life circumstances, to situations freely and clearly, which we are innately able to do, but it's that innate ability is covered up by all this conditioning and all these assumptions and this basically this self-image. So to see where we're caught and to let go those stuck places, as a good friend of mine calls them, where we are kind of knee-jerk reacting to a situation when we feel like we've been accused, or we feel like we've been embarrassed, or we feel like we are left out, or any of the other things that trigger the reaction born of this idea of ourself. When we are able to be clear and let go enough of this self-image by seeing through it. And with each extended out-breath, we are practicing letting go. Letting go that self-image, even though we're not sitting there thinking something and trying to let go the something that we're thinking. That doesn't matter. In fact, that would probably not work very well. But each time we extend that out-breath, we are letting everything else go in order to do it. And that begins to add up to an ability to be less invested in our personal ideas, our personal assumptions. And along with that, our need to support, defend, uphold a self-image that really is an artificial construct. Now, before you get too excited about this idea, it doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to function in society, because you will actually function more clearly and more ably with less stickiness. The more we can be free of that self-image. So it actually allows us to function in deeper, more effective ways than we can when we are still caught in needing to act out of that self-image. The other deeper meaning liberating all sentient beings really is that as we go deep enough to recognize this, we realize that there is no separation between me and you, between all of us, not to mention all of us human beings, but also all of us and animals and trees and buildings, the airplane that's flying overhead right now, and the people in it. And so when we are able to reach a level of clarity and let go-ness in our own mind, that is felt by anyone who's sensitive to it, and it registers even if we're not sensitive to it on other people. We're seeing the opposite happening right now in politics, where a disdain for people, an ease with insulting people, making fun of people, establishing untruths, trying to create an image, an illusion that things are not the way they are, in an attempt to convince everybody else that they're really the way any particular person thinks they are. This is kind of the opposite of that. And unfortunately, that's also registering in people's psyches and in the environment. We're all linked. One person can't do anything without it reverberating among all beings and the whole universe. And so the more we are able to clarify our own mind and let go of attachment to particularly the self-image, or a way of having to have things in our lives, or a way of having to live, a way of having to do things, then that reverberates as well. This is what Jacques Le Seurin was able to do in Buchenwald. He was able to free himself of a need to have to live in a particular way that was the only way possible in outside of Buchenwald. In Buchenwald, there was no way of living with sufficient food, with sufficient rest, with ease, with safety. And when he let go his felt need to have it that way, he found joy. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. So that's a two-pronged expression of the Mahayana ideal, the Bodhisattva ideal, of coming to liberation for the benefit of all beings. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. And here, as you heard earlier a couple times in Sesshin, there are three translators of Chinese and Japanese who have recently said that this is an inaccurate translation of the early Chinese that it came out of. And Daiyo and Sogen and Yuho are all working together, putting their heads together to explore better wording, more optimal, more appropriate, more accurate wording for that vow. We could say a lot about it. For one thing, desires, we don't want to put an end to desires. There are certain desires that are essential, such as a desire to eat, a desire to sleep, a desire to drink liquid, to go to the bathroom. And these are essential to maintaining life. And if we don't drink and we don't eat and we don't sleep and we don't go to the bathroom, we won't last very long in this life. And yet, as the Buddha discovered himself, realized himself, not necessarily discovered, if we don't have a body how are we going to come to awakening? We have this chance to do this work now, that we have this body, we have this opportunity to practice. We have this opportunity to work with a teacher so that we can liberate ourselves and, as part of that, work towards the liberation of all beings. So perhaps a better word would be attachments. Attachments are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. But even that, putting an end to them, yes, but that sounds rather aggressive, and it's more like I vow to let them go. I vow to see through them and let them go. So that vow is still awaiting appropriate translation. In the meantime, we'll go ahead and chant it. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. And just with a side note that it's not 100% accurate, that translation, and the real deeper meaning is letting go our stuck places. The dharmas are boundless, I vow to master them. Dharmas with a capital D refers to the teachings of the Buddha, as well as the teachings that have come down to us as from enlightened masters. And there are many of those. Think about Tore Enji's Bodhisattva vow. This is an enlightened view and a direction for ethical, appropriate, harmonious, compassionate behavior. With a small d, dharmas refers to phenomena. As well, when we encounter a situation that's challenging, particularly one that's challenging, and it could be any situation, but particularly one that's challenging because that's more motivating, it can become a dharmagit. And that's actually the literal translation. Ho mon moryo segan gaku. Ho is dharma, mon is gate. I vow to gaku is to study, but it really goes beyond that. When something difficult happens to us, it's an opportunity to, instead of going through an old habit pattern of reactivity, to stop for a moment and take a look at maybe there's a different way. And the more clear we are in our practice, the more we are able to become aware of a different way, a way to respond rather than to react. And that can potentially become a gate to awakening. It certainly can become a gate to less stress and some insight, which of course is on the way to awakening anyway. The dharmas are boundless, I vow to the next vow, the final vow, in literal translation is, the Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Sometimes that's translated as I vow to attain it, but there's nothing to attain. Become is a much more accurate expression of the process. And we've changed that wording from the Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it, because at one point, a woman came to Hidden Valley Zen Center. She was bringing her son to learn meditation. And she told me that when she was 6 years old and went through her first communion, she had an experience which she described, and it sounded like it could well have been a legitimate Kensho experience. And based on the woman's demeanor, and her son was 17 years old, so this has been a while since she was six, I suspect that it really was an authentic awakening experience. She had no knowledge at the time of Buddhism. She was going to her first communion in a Catholic church. So how can we say the Buddha way isn't unsurpassable? For that matter, there's Flora Courtois, who had a profound awakening with no context for religion at all. Or Jacques Lucerne, who had a profound awakening, again, no context for religion at all. So there are many ways to come to awakening. And the Buddha way is one that is extremely helpful because it has a path that people can be guided on, whereas many of the other religions do not. And yet, it isn't the only way to come to awakening. And so we say the way of liberation is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And becoming it is far more than I vow to awaken to it. Because when we actually become it, we're expressing it fully in everything we do or say or think. And that is vital to our practice. We cannot consider that we are awakened until that is complete. And that can take lifetimes, but don't feel daunted by that, because it is a joyful undertaking. And the fact that you are sitting here on day 7 of Sesshin is evidence that you've got a deep commitment to practice and to coming to awakening for the benefit of all beings. So the main thing is to persist, to keep going, and to keep going despite what it may seem like, because our psyche is for a long time divided. Part of us wants deeply to come to awakening, to become free. But another part of us is quite frightened of that, and one might even say terrified of that. This is why there is this expression, let go your hold on the cliff and drop, hands held high into the fiery abyss. It can feel like that. And it's normal for fear to come up for people at a certain point in practice. But that actually is a good sign, because it means that you're getting close enough to the edge of the cliff that you could actually take that leap. And that could take some time. Kapler-Roshi was fond of telling people when they were getting near, you only have half a step further to go. And I remember a good friend of mine, Jay Thompson, saying to some of us, how would you feel if you got told that any number of times in succeeding Sesshin, you only have half a step to go. Next Sesshin, you only have half a step to go. Next Sesshin, you only have half a step to go. Well, how come you're not finishing that? How come you're not down to a quarter of a step, or an eighth of a step, or taking that great leap? It takes time, but the time is not wasted. Every time you extend that out-breath, you are letting go. And that is the most vital component of this practice. The extended out breath is an incredibly wise and effective practice for doing that. But the reason why the three pillars of Zen are patient forbearance, faith, determination, which is part of that patient forbearance, and this great doubt, this sense that there's something more beyond what we can know with our intellect, that is freeing in profound ways, and it is. And we can reach it. That's the faith part. The faith also is what helps us continue regardless of how long it takes or how difficult it is. For some people, it's relatively quick and easy. For other people, it takes a longer time. I know people who have worked 20 years, 30 years on practice, and only then finally had a kensho. Often, when it takes that long, the kensho is truly deep. So, be patient. Remember Seppo, who was in tears after having practiced for quite a long time because he hadn't yet had kensho. And yet, eventually he got it and was a highly skilled, effective teacher for many years afterwards. As we are doing this practice, inner changes are taking place, and they're forming a ground, a basis, so that when we do have an insight deep enough to be called kensho, it will stick. We'll be able to make use of it. If kensho comes too soon, it won't work. We won't have any way to manifest it. Many, many years ago, a man came to Kapil Rishi back in the 1960s when the Rochester Zen Center was brand new. So this is a while after the Second World War. It's more than 20 years after the Second World War, as a matter of fact. And the man had been a soldier in the invasion of Normandy. And he survived. A lot of people didn't. It was a brutal, brutal massacre. And it caused him to, when he got back to the United States at the end of the war, wander aimlessly through the streets of New York City, bumping into streetlights and telephone poles, because he was so absorbed in this question of why is there suffering? How could there be such carnage? How can this happen? Why? And after 6 months, he had a kensho experience. But by the time he came to see Kapil Rishi, it was just a memory. Somebody told him that if he went to see Rishi Kapil, that he might be able to help him re-up the experience. And Kapil Rishi said that if he started doing Zazen, he could get back to it and deepen it and expand it and live it. But he never heard from the man again, so perhaps that was more work than the guy wanted to do. And it is work to do the practice. It's not something that everybody is willing to do. And that is why those of you who are sitting here right now are so fortunate that your karma is good enough that you can come to Sesshin, that you can continue to do this work as deeply as you're doing it, that you are willing to persist. And it's an honor to be here with you all, sharing this in this Sesshin, the last moments of this Sesshin with you. I think that's enough. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.